Our first person tonight is Bill Rush. And have I got your name right there, Bill?
Of course not.
Now, Bill is from he's the managing director of Garage Technology Ventures, a Californian-based seed and early-stage venture capital fund. Garage Technology Ventures are willing to invest in unproven teams attacking unproven markets with unproven solutions.
Sounds risky.
Mate, have I got a deal for you? Yeah, I've got this idea. So we should have find some few things to interest here in Wellington, which is the best city in the world to start a software company. Now a little bit more about Bill. Earlier in his career, he worked at McKinsey and Company, Brown Brothers, Harman and Co., and the World Bank. Cool. He was a founding board member of and chairman of Churchill Club, and a chartered member of the Silicon Valley Association of Startup Entrepreneurs. It's quite a mouthful. Currently, he is the chairman of the Small Fund Roundtable of VC Task Force and a member of the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. So the reason why I'm smiling is that I love the way that American companies have such long names. That's great presentations. Bill has a very broad topic today, which is the future of innovation, entrepreneurship, venture capital, and emerging technologies. And of course, as we said, we can open the floor to questions later on. So, Bill, the stand is yours.
Great. Thank you. So, well, thank you. Thank you very much. It is my great pleasure and distinct honor to have the opportunity to speak with you here today. We were fiddling with the technology early on. I'm assuming it will work perfectly. I have no doubts whatsoever. We'll see if we can get this to work. But just briefly, thank you. Thank you very much for the generous introduction there and the pieces of my bio that you picked up on. Perhaps more relevant than some of the elements that were emphasized there. I've spent most of my career as an entrepreneur, primarily in the software space. I started a software company when I was in graduate school at Stanford many years ago, and was a founder, co-founder of four venture-backed startups in the subsequent years, prior to founding Garage about 10 years ago now. I started Garage with a gentleman by the name of Guy Kawasaki, who was at Apple Computer and is well known as a writer, author, speaker on the subject of entrepreneurship and marketing, and with a few other guys about 10 years ago, primarily around the idea that we wanted to help stimulate entrepreneurship more broadly than just starting up one more startup company. And so the big idea behind Garage was that the next big thing wasn't the internet, it wasn't SaaS, it wasn't cloud, it wasn't nanotechnology. The next big thing was entrepreneurship. And we saw that happening not just in the United States, but also globally. And so we've always had as one of our fundamental mantras that we wanted to reach out, cast the net broadly, to reach out and touch entrepreneurs as broadly as we could, wherever they were, anywhere in the world. And, you know, mission statements or mantras like that are the sort of thing that get me invited to come down here to New Zealand to meet all of you and have this opportunity to talk. So now I've been here in New Zealand approximately 10 hours, I guess. So having used that time as efficiently as I could to absorb all of the lessons and learnings and insights into what's going on down here in New Zealand, I quickly cobbled together a presentation for you on the topic of the future of innovation and discussing in particular entrepreneurship and venture capital. In this new world. Now, I still am not entirely sure how the Great Global Meltdown has affected you guys individually. I sense, generally speaking, New Zealand is going to survive, so that's good news. And that generally business is going to go on, so that's good news. But from where I am in Silicon Valley, it was pretty dire there for a while. It's still pretty dreadful in terms of the environment now, for entrepreneurs and for raising venture capital. So it certainly seems as though, and now we get to see if this works. Ah, my Okay.
Now, okay, I'll get this.
Okay.
Left side. Just the other side.
Yeah, right. Okay, there's got to be a... there's going to have to be a better solution to this.
Just hit the left button.
Uh-oh. Well, hey, I can learn. Okay. Right, so, in any case, in case you lost the thread of my thought while I was dealing with the technology, the point I wanted to make here is that the future ain't what it used to be. We were just talking earlier, and this was by a famous American by the name of Yogi Berra. And we were talking a little bit earlier about how, you know, wouldn't it be great if, you know, after all of this mess, we get back to kind of the way it was in the 90s. And, you know, in the 90s, again, I'm not sure exactly how it was here in the 90s, but I'll tell you, in Silicon Valley in the 90s, God, life was good. The U.S. was running a surplus, and money was gushing out of everybody's ears. It was just really nice. You, all you had to do was come up with a business plan, and some VC would throw $4 or $5 million at you. It was a really good time. But at the, you know, we're not going to see that again. So for those of you who missed it, don't worry, because all of us are missing it, you know, once again. So it's going to be a future of somewhat lowered expectations in terms of things like IPOs and valuations and the flow of venture capital. But nevertheless, there is a future, and there is going to be a future of it and for innovation. And to be honest, in spite of the meltdown, we see no lack of innovation. We see no lack of opportunity for very successful, innovative companies to get launched and to build global presence, even in this horrific global environment. The trick, of course, is to have the right skills and attitudes. And so this is one of my favorite quotes about entrepreneurship and what it takes to be successful. The quote goes, "The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man, or as the case may be, woman." This was George Bernard Shaw. And so what all of us in this room already know is that if you've chosen to be an entrepreneur, you're undoubtedly disturbed at some level. Somehow, you've got some perverse perspective on the world that causes you to be in this room. Otherwise, you'd be doing something normal that your parents would have suggested you do, you know, long ago when you were at university. But no, that's not where we are. We all think that the world can be different, that indeed it is, and we all think that we can be instrumental in changing it to become a better world. And so that's what we're here trying to do. We're trying to invent the future because we think that's the way that life is going to be most fun to live. But the future ain't what it used to be. And so we got to think about doing things differently in order to be successful in the future. And so what I came up with a little before this meeting are the top 10 rules for entrepreneurs and investors in this new future that we now face. Having said that, now I think I've got 12 minutes left, so I will try to give you the top 10 rules in, you know, as efficiently as possible, because I want to have some Q&A as well. So rule number one has to do with the fundamental objective of entrepreneurship. In the old days, the rule was create wealth, right? That's what we were taught in business school. That was the big idea. That was the whole point of the exercise, was let's make lots of money. But in fact, the new rule is you got to create value. And we've lost track of that. We keep losing track of this, that all too often, you know, we as venture capitalists see entrepreneurs who think they've got a clever idea where they can go launch some website, get a few million eyeballs, flip it for a few million bucks, make a pot of money, and get rich quick. And that leads to entrepreneurs trying to find an easy path towards something that's interesting, that's easy and fun, and potentially can be life-changing in terms of creating wealth. But the reality is, people like that hardly ever succeed. You know, the other 200 companies that launched behind MySpace and Facebook wanting to be the next big social search engine or whatever, those 200 companies are not going to succeed, and people are going to waste a couple of years of their lives trying to chase what they think is a quick win. Instead, what we all know is you've got to figure out a way to start a company that's really going to create value. And even if you only create value for, you know, a relatively small number of companies or people, it's a start. truly creating value rather than trying to do something that you hope you can sell quickly for a big pot of money. Rule number two has to do with how you get started. The old rule and sort of the myth of entrepreneurship is that brilliant companies are started by brilliant founders. And, you know, that seems generally true, but the reality, in fact, is that brilliant companies are started by brilliant teams. And if you look at every single great company out there, what you discover is that even if there's a brand name individual who seems to be associated with it, for every Bill Gates, there was a Paul Allen. For every Steve Jobs, there was a Steve Wozniak. For every Scott McNeely, there was a Vinod Khosla and Bill Joy and all those other guys behind him. For every Hewlett, there was a Packard. Every company, every brilliant company is a team of founders that start up the company. So what that means is if you're an entrepreneur, you have got to be effective building a team. It's not enough to be brilliant, visionary, and charismatic. You've got to figure out how you can cobble together a team to be successful. The parable of the optimist, the pessimist, and the engineer. And this is something we look at in every team. So, you know, normally, of course, the optimist is the person who sees a glass and says, this glass is half full. And the pessimist is the person who looks at the glass and says, this glass is half empty. And the engineer is the person who looks at the glass and says, this glass was engineered to be twice as big as it needs to be. So, and the lesson of the parable is, in any effective team, you have to have all three personality types. You've got to have the optimist, the person who's going to keep on charging in spite of all obstacles, but you have to have the pessimist, the person who sees the obstacles and thinks about ways to avoid the obstacles and thinks about ways to change things if, in fact, you run smack dab into the obstacle. And, of course, you have to have the engineer. You have to have the realist, the person who says, you know, I don't care if it's good or bad, I'm just going to solve the problem. I'm going to figure out a way to make it work. And the person who looks at the world objectively without a particular attitude and goes out and solves the problem. They are different personality types. And so when we see a team of three passionate visionaries, it's not good enough. You know, we got to see the complementarity on the team. Rule number three has to do with how you share the vision. The old rule was you craft a mission statement. You sit down, you get everybody around the table, and you write out a big mission statement. The new rule is create a mantra. This is a rule that I stole from my partner, Guy Kawasaki, who has written about it in various books of his. But the point is that a lot of teams lose the ability to articulate their core focus, their core effort, in a very short, succinct phrase. Instead, what they do is what most companies do, is they create a mission statement, and this is actually a mission statement of a big public company in the United States, where the mission of this company is to deliver superior quality products and services for our customers and communities through leadership, innovation, and partnerships. Great mission. You know, it warms the cockles of your heart, but it doesn't say anything about what this company does or what this company's focus is, and it doesn't bring the team together in any focused way around what they're doing. Here's another great mission statement. We exist to professionally build long-term high-impact sources so that we may endeavor to synergistically leverage existing effective deliverables to stay competitive in tomorrow's world. An equally meaningful mission statement, right? So, this is... So I'll tell you, so the second one was a parody. The first one was the mission statement of a fast food company called Wendy's. And how you attach that mission statement to Wendy's, I don't know. And how it moves people to serve better hamburgers, I'm not clear on. But the point is, don't fiddle with these mission statements that every sort of business plan writing book or coach or consultant will tell you to do. Think instead about cutting down to the shortest possible three or four words that really articulate what it is you do. You know, FedEx got this really early on. I mean, FedEx, you know, we get it there tomorrow, absolutely, right? Nike, slightly different, you know, just do it, but Nike is all focused on, you know, on athletes and getting things done. And so find a mantra for your organization that doesn't just motivate yourself and the team immediately around it, but it communicates to your community, your stakeholders, what it is you do. Rule number four has to do with management style. The old rule was plan the work, work the plan. That's what we all learned when we went through business school or management trainee programs, or you read books or whatever it is. The new rule is get going, get going. In this current environment, again, you don't have time to be writing business plans. You don't have time to be developing PowerPoint presentations. You've got to get out there. And what we look for in a team is not a team that has got the most beautiful, most well-crafted business plan and pitch. We look for the team that's been out there with 12 customers and is coming back with detailed feedback on the needs and requirements and all of the input from having actually been out there talking with customers, trying to sell, trying to make money from those customers. And so particularly in this environment, you can't afford to sit back and try to worry about how am I going to raise venture capital. You've got to get out there to the market and talk to customers and find out if you build something for them, will they buy it? And if you're going to build something, what's the best thing for you to build? And then, by the way, will they pay for it before you build it? Even better, right? So get going. Rule number 5 has to do with your business model. The old rule was you go out, you raise venture capital, and you start a business. The new rule, as you can guess from my last comment, is you got to bootstrap. Again, in this environment, it is highly unlikely that you're going to be able to raise venture capital. And so what choice does that leave you with? Well, maybe there's some angels. Maybe your uncle has a big pot of money somewhere buried in the garden. I don't know. But most likely, your best source of capital for running your business is going to be your customer base. And so increasingly, what we see are guys who are putting something together and they're going out to a company and they're trying to convince that company to give them some NRE, non-recurring engineering money, to go do a project for them, to build something productized that they can then take, flip, and turn into a product that they can sell to somebody else for even more money. So you got to figure out ways to bootstrap, and there are a variety of ways of bootstrapping, and I think that's part of the energy right now in the entrepreneur community, is figuring out ways to generate money, to generate revenues before you go raise venture capital. The flip side is, if you're going to raise venture capital, the only way you're going to raise venture capital these days is if, quote unquote, you don't need it. In other words, if you can get out there and you can prove that you've got a product that somebody wants, that's when the VCs will be interested. If you go out there with a PowerPoint presentation and a lot of good testimonials and maybe a Nobel laureate or two on your advisory board, they'll smile, they'll nod, they'll say, wow, that's really cool, you've got those Nobel laureates on your advisory board. What's your market traction? And that's what's gonna get venture capital these days. Rule number 6 has to do with the foundation of innovation. So, as you can see, I tailored this for this audience, okay? So, it used to be that, the entrepreneur community in the United States, it's Yankee ingenuity. In the United States, there's a culture of entrepreneurship, a strong historical culture of entrepreneurship around what is called Yankee ingenuity. God dang it, we're Americans, we can figure it out, we can make it work. And it is my understanding from my 10 hours here in the country. But there's a very similar culture here in New Zealand around Kiwi ingenuity. And, the presumption is, by definition, you would not be here in this country if there wasn't something in your DNA that caused either you or someone, one of your ancestors or father, great-father, grandfather, whatever, to leave some comfortable place somewhere else in the world and come here. So that's, it's part of what makes Silicon Valley what it is. There's nobody in Silicon Valley who didn't choose to come to Silicon Valley. I don't know if it's true, when I was in Australia, I was very clear that not everybody chose to go to Australia. But in the case of New Zealand, it is my understanding that you guys all chose to be here. So that, that breeds the certain energy of entrepreneurship and ingenuity, but the reality is it's about global know-how. And so, when we see a team come in the door, we look at them and we say, okay, you've got to be global day one. Now, that doesn't mean that day one you're off trying to sell in Japan. But it does mean that day one you're designing your company, you're designing your team, you're designing your business model to be able to go offshore, to be able to go international, to be able to go take on the world. Because in the current environment, even if you were satisfied with the idea that, you know, if I can own this market, that's good enough, I can get a big enough business. Even if you're satisfied with that, the risk is that somebody from the outside is just going to roll right through New Zealand and crush you on their way to some other part of the world. So you've got to be global day one, and that means you have to tap in. You have to know how to tap into the capabilities of the globe on day one. And that means combination of teams. It means strategic partnerships. It means channels of distribution. It may mean capital. It certainly means customers. But part of the advantage that you've got here in New Zealand is you are more global than most people in America. You know, most people who were born and raised in America have never been outside of the United States. It's stunning. But most entrepreneurial teams that we actually see come into our office are the ones, I should say, that actually make it that far in our process, that they come into their office. Most of them, a third to a half of the people on the team weren't even born in the United States. You know, and most of those teams have links day one to how they're going to become global companies. And that's important to the investors because the investors want to know that you're going to be preemptively reaching out globally. However small you start, you're going to reach out to make sure that you get a competitive advantage globally in order to become a global company. So, tap the globe, then what? Competitive advantage, speaking of which. The old rule was it was all about being the first mover. You know, if, and then this was the in the era of the 90s, it was, you know, are you the first company to come up with selling dog food on the internet or whatever brilliant idea you may have had in the 90s. And entrepreneurs would come in and they say, well, yeah, you know, we got this great business idea and we're going to be the first movers. And somehow that thought was because we're the first movers and because the internet moves so quickly, therefore we were going to win. But what we know is that almost always it's the fast adapter that is the company that wins the game. Right? So if you look throughout the history of high technology, the company that wound up winning was not the company that invented the technology on which they won. So you take, for example, I mean, again, Facebook is a latecomer to social networking in the grand scheme of social networks. There were social network companies way back in the 90s. Facebook tapped something. They had a different platform as the technology evolved. They were by no means the first mover, and, you know, even if you include MySpace as being prior to them. But Cisco didn't invent the router. You know, Bill Gates did not invent the operating system. To pick a company, you know, Larry Ellison did not invent relational databases. So, again, big companies aren't successful because they were the first movers. They were fast adapters. They were better at integrating innovation and taking it to the globe than the guys who came first. So don't tell an investor you're the first one. Tell the investor that you can beat the first guys because you've got this insight into why you can do it better. Rule number 8 has to do with your marketing strategy. The old rule was build it and they will come. I mean, and this is the standard engineer's approach to solving a big problem. And again, we still have this issue with teams coming into our office, particularly engineering-driven teams. They are so enamored with the brilliance of their innovation that they assume if only, you know, we can get Guy Kawasaki to blog about it, then, you know, game over, right? We'll take over the world. The reality is, in the new world, everyone has to sell. And so you have to have a culture from the founders, from the engineers, all the way across, even to the people in sales and marketing, to the person at the front desk, to understand what it is that the customer wants, to fight for the customer's needs, to always be focused on figuring out what it is that's going to be most effective selling. Again, you know, you look at a guy like Bill Gates, you know, by genetic disposition, he's not what you think of as a sales guy. But Bill Gates was a brilliant salesman, right? Bill Gates sold an operating system to IBM, right? So everybody in the company has got to be an effective salesperson. You cannot, as a technical founder, say, you know, I'm just going to build a great technology here and we'll go hire some of those guys with, you know, goatees and cologne and fast cars and they can sell it for us, right? Let's leave me in my lab to develop that product. That ain't going to work because you've got, even as a technical founder, you've got to be able to reach out to the customers and talk with the customers and build the product appropriately. Rule number 9 has to do with the pace of change. And this is the hardest one for me to get my own head around. It's the most it's the biggest conundrum that we have found in venture capital, because we've grown up, and now in the current environment, you know, every day in the newspaper and wherever, someone says that the pace of change is accelerating. And for a whole bunch of reasons, we talk ourselves into this sense that the you know, the internet is exploding and new technologies are evolving, that the pace of change is exploding at an incredibly rapid pace, right? And that's common wisdom. But the reality is, we fool ourselves with that frame of reference. And so the reality is, change takes time. Any innovation takes a stunningly long amount of time for people to adopt, to change the way they're doing things, to adopt new technologies, to adopt new approaches to things. And so every single business plan on the face of this planet is excessively optimistic in terms of its sales ramp. I don't care who you are. I don't care how conservative your planning process is. You're going to think that things will happen faster than they do, and that will always get you into trouble. You will get into trouble because you think that, oh my gosh, you know, the competition's going to come, and other things are going to happen, and competitors are going to see the brilliance of my idea, and so this world is, you know, this world is going to change like that. And so, but the reality is, you go back and you look at some of the things that were said in 97, 98, 99 about the way the internet was going to evolve. You know, bandwidth was going to be infinite, storage was going to be infinite, all these things were going to happen by 2000. You know, and, you know, we're just now getting to some of those visions 10 years later. So I won't go over my rant on how slowly things have evolved over the years, that in all of these sectors, we as a technical population have under-delivered on what we promised 10 and 20 years ago, if you think back on what we thought was going to evolve. So don't get trapped. The point is, don't get trapped thinking things are moving too quickly. So last rule, rule number 10, what is the source of innovation? The old rule, the Silicon Valley engineer-centric rule, was technology drives innovation. New technologies beget more new technologies. More new technologies beget brilliant, innovative ways to implement those two technologies. But what we often miss is that, in fact, people trump technology. It's always about people. It's about people when you're starting your company and you're trying to build a team. It's about people when you're going out and talking to customers and trying to figure out, are they telling you the truth about what they want, what they need? It's about, you know, other stakeholders. It's about investors. Who's going to bet money on you being successful? It's about, you know, finding strategic partners other places in the globe and figuring out the cultural differences. It's about the people. That's what really causes a company to succeed or to fail. It's easy to make technologies work. It's easy to make, you know, build a widget or a software or whatever it is that will in fact function. It is really hard to get the people part of the problem correct. So keep that in mind as you're building your company. So in sum, those are the top 10 rules. Create value. Don't focus on making just getting yourself rich. Build a team. Develop a mantra. Get going. Get out there. Learn to bootstrap your company. Don't depend on venture capital. Be global day one. Be a fast adapter. Make sure everyone is focused on selling. Be realistic about the pace of adoption. And remember that people trump technology. So that's what I've learned in my 10 hours here in New Zealand. And so now what I don't know is if anybody here wants a copy of the slides, if unlimited potential is the way to go, or you can email me, or both, or above, or you can post these if you want, however you want to do that. I'll send them to Scott, and we can do that. Or that's my email, reichert@garage.com. Feel free to ask a question, follow up, whatever. And also mention that we have resources on our website for entrepreneurs that you may want to look into. Guy has written two books in the last 10 years. One's called The Art of the Start, which is a compilation of all of the wisdom we gain at Garage about kind of what works and what doesn't work. It's a very good handbook for entrepreneurs if you haven't already read it. And more recently, a collection of his blogs called Reality Check. Again, a more updated discussion of kind of what works, what doesn't work if you're an entrepreneur. So we might have a couple of minutes for questions. Is that true?
Yes.
We do. Okay. I'd love to ask or answer questions. I'd love to ask you questions too. So.